The following is a message from HeritageFoodsUSA.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be.
It is Thursday at 1 o'clock, and you are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to the Farm Report, coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on this gloomy, gloomy summer day. We're hoping to cheer things up, though. We have a Nick Fantasma on the line from Paradise Lockers. Nick, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
You ready to bring a ray of sunshine into the gloomy Brooklyn day?
I'm certainly hoping so.
What's happening over on your end? You got sunshine?
Oh, it's a gorgeous day out here.
Oh, man. This is when I really need my teletransporter. So, Nick, it's great to have you on. I know you've been on, I believe you've been on the show before with Heather, right?
Yes.
Back in the day. So, just in case someone maybe missed that one episode, why don't we give them a quick rundown of Paradise Locker and what you do there?
All right. Well, we're a family-owned slaughter and processing facility in Trimble, Missouri, about a half hour north of downtown Kansas City. We do a lot of custom processing for local farmers, individuals, and companies such as Heritage Foods. As well as we have a full retail store up front where we carry all of our high-quality beef, pork, and poultry products.
So you're like the one-stop shop for all of your meat needs. When in Trimble, come on down.
Absolutely.
So you said it's a family-run business. How long has the family been at the butchering business and the slaughtering processing? Did that start at the same time, or did you start with one and added the other? How did it kind of get initiated?
Well, we were. My dad has been in the meat business for. He was a wholesale meat cutter for 17, 18 years before he bought the locker. And we bought the locker in 1995. January of 95 is when we took over the business. And we've pretty much all been there ever since the beginning.
Awesome. And you deal, so I know you do a lot of work for Heritage doing pigs, and you do some beef for us. What are you doing other animals? Do you guys do goats or lamb or anything like that?
We do. We slaughter beef, pork, and lamb, and some goats. We don't do a lot of the lamb and goats, but there are a few farmers around here that raise them locally, and we process those for them on the local level for farmers markets and different things like that, and some just for people that are doing custom slaughter for their own home use.
So custom slaughter, what is that? How does that differ from regular slaughter?
Custom slaughter is just, in essence, is a farmer bringing us an animal for us to process it for them, and them taking it home and putting it in their freezer for them to have for the year, for a half a year or something, anything like that. Whereas USDA slaughter, anything done under USDA can be resold throughout the country.
Excellent. And so to have it done under USDA regulations, what does that mean? I mean, you guys actually have an inspector who's in plant at all times with you, right?
Yes.
And I know in New York State, I'm assuming it's the same with you guys. Like, do they really have to have their own bathroom?
Yeah, they have to have...
They don't have to have their own bathroom
here, but he does have to have his own office with phone and internet access that we provide for him.
You're like a pizza oven, a small line of dancing girls, and let's see, what else would I like? No, I'm just
exactly.
kidding.
Exactly. Anything to keep him happy. No.
Of course. So, this is a Farm Report. I kind of want to talk about things a little bit from the farmer's perspective. So if I am a farmer in your area and I, have my small herd of beef cattle and I want to get on your slaughter schedule, what does that look like? I mean, are you guys on a wait? Is it something that it takes a while for me to get in? Like, how busy are you?
We typically stay about a month ahead as far as our scheduling goes for our slaughter.
Okay.
And it depends on the time of the year, too. You know, of course, during the hot summer months, you know, we're a little bit more open. When we get closed into fall, usually by September, first part of October, we're booked throughout the fall. We stopped doing whole deer processing a few years back, and everybody kind of knows that now because of our account with Heritage Foods. We can't really shut down for deer season anymore. So,
right, and I feel like that has, like, for, that's been my impression. You know, Eagle Bridge Custom Meats is a slaughterhouse that I've worked with quite a bit here in New York State, and they, similarly, that was for a long time a big part of their business is working with the local hunters, and as they grew to have kind of more more clients, that was something that they let go of. It seems like smaller scale regional slaughterhouses have been kind of undergirded by the hunters and communities, and so it sounds like that's on some level a success. Is there someone else in your area who's kind of risen to meet that need for hunters in the fall?
Well, there's a lot of Missouri processors. There's a lot of processing plants in the state of Missouri. Some USDA, some just custom. There's definitely people that that we can refer others to, that we do refer others to, you know, hunters and that kind of thing. We've still kept up doing our Share the Harvest program, which is a Missouri conservation program where hunters can donate their deers. We bring them in, process them, and have a couple different organizations that will come and pick up the meat and take it to local food pantries.
Oh, wow.
So we've continued to do that just because we really believe in the program and think it's a, you know, it's a good way. It feeds a lot of people. I think one of the top years that we had, I believe, was back in 2005, where statewide there was about 268,000 pounds of venison that was donated to local food pantries.
Oh, that is like a score. I mean, as someone who grew up eating venison kind of year-round, fresh and from the freezer, I have to say, like, what a treat to go to your local food pantry and be able to have that as an option. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's always been a really good program that we've always believed in. So that's something that we don't really want to, you know, we want to try and keep going with that as much as possible. But, you know, as we get into doing more USDA work, it's getting harder and harder just because wild game being a non-inspectable product, because it is wild, and you know, it has to be completely segregated inside the plant. And when you deal with the space issues and the kind of those kind of things that we deal with, it makes it a little difficult. But like I said, you know, we really believe in the program, and it does a lot of good for a lot of people. So that's something that we've kept up on, and then keeping up on. We still take in boneless meat if someone wants to do their own processing at home, bone mm-hmm. out the meat and bring it in to us. We'll still do summer sausage, jerky, snack sticks, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm hungry. So what do you, you know, you mentioned there's a lot of slaughtering facilities and processing facilities in the state of Missouri. I mean, why do you think that is? Do you think that there's just more animal and livestock production? Because I know that's definitely a big struggle out here in the Northeast, especially for small and medium scale farms. Is really not uncommon for people to drive 2, 3, even 4 hours to get their animals processed. It sounds like that's not the case in Missouri. Why do you think that is?
I think just the availability of the need for it. You know, the Midwest has always been, you know, more of an agricultural community or an agricultural business here in the Midwest with livestock farms and crop farms and different things like that. So the need for it has been more here. We're kind of out on the coasts, you know, for a while, you know, and it's starting to come back now, which is reassuring, you know, definitely promising, and getting excited to see more and more people getting into the farming and the raising of animals back out on the coast. But I think people got away from it. You know, it's through the 70s and 80s and 90s, you know, everybody's been relying on grocery stores for their foods, and you know, it hasn't the demand for locally, sustainably raised, naturally raised animals coming from your small butcher shops, the demand really hasn't been there in the last 20 to 30 years.
Okay, so like things are coming full circle out on the coast. So now,
I
think now it's like we're looking to you. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. I know there recently, you know, Josh Applestone from Fleischer's just put out a book on butchering. I think there's been several in the last couple of years that, in addition to, you know, numerous articles in the Times or New York Magazine about kind of the rise of butchers as this new rock star. I know that's the thing we see a lot in New York City as different, like, smaller scale butchering shops open up and restaurants start to identify themselves by their in-house charcuterie or sausage making. I mean, have you found that you can walk with a little more swagger in your step when you're heading downtown to, you know, pick up your carton of milk? I mean, do people look at you as a sex symbol now? Has that really changed for you, or?
It's funny that you say that. It's kinda, you know, pretty much any time, you know, I don't know, 8 out of 10 people that I talk to, or you know, that just in general conversation throughout the day, or somebody that you meet in public or anything, you know, you tell them that you work at a slaughterhouse, and you know, I would say probably 7 or 8 out of 10 people still kind of wrinkle their nose at you. But I do see it becoming more of a, you know, the whole rock star chef icon, chef status has grown, you know, since Emeril and Mario Batali started on with their TV shows and everything. You know, within the last 15 to 20 years, you know, that has, of course, blown up. And, you know, everybody, it's you see a lot more people going into the culinary arts.
But you still don't see
a huge outcry for, you know, college kids that are going for agriculture or for ag business or for, you know, getting into butchering.
Yeah, what is that, your background? I mean, how does someone... I guess, you know, my sense has always been that it's more of an apprentice-based position where you find someone to study under, but are there more established kind of training or programming, or, you know, do the folks who work down at Paradise have to go through particular certifications to be able to work? And what's your staffing situation look like?
As far as certifications or anything that we require of our employees, it's basically on-site training. You know, of course, we like to have someone who has been involved in the business and knows what to do. But the vast majority of our employees came to us with no experience whatsoever.
So you're training them on-site.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, for me, my brother, you know. We started, I was 13 when my parents bought the business, and my brother was 15. So, you know, it's been kind of a life lesson for us, you know, as we grew up learning the business and going to what we know now. But you don't, they're at the universities, at some of the major universities across the Midwest, the ag programs are starting to get a lot better. University of Missouri in Columbia has a wonderful ag program, where they actually do. They have a butcher shop. They have a slaughter facility and a processing facility on campus. And they actually have their own little meat shop there on campus where kids can come in and buy snack sticks and jerky and steaks and, you know, different things like that. And it's proven to be a very good program for them. And it's, you know, so there are some universities out there that are teaching the fundamentals of the butchering, the slaughtering, processing, different things like that. But it's just not as mainstream across the entire country.
Right, not yet anyway. Well, we're going to go to a break for a quick moment, and when we come back, we'll tuck into a little bit more of the butchering and slaughter talk.
Sound good.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we are back. We are on the line with Nick Fantasma of Paradise Lockers, talking about the what's what of slaughterhouses and butchering. So, Nick, I want to kind of scale back a little bit and talk a little bit about what the infrastructure for your operation looks like. I know you guys bought it. It was an existing space. But if let's say I was someone new, or say you or your brother were like, that's it, I can't work with my mom and dad no more, I'm like moving to New York, I'm gonna do my own thing. What kind of startup equipment or costs or regulations are you looking at if you want to get into this business?
It's a big undertaking. There's a lot of equipment involved, and depending on the scale that you want to go, that you're trying to do with it. Whether you're wanting to go under USDA, whether you're just wanting to do a custom slaughter facility that does, you know, that services your local community and hunters and that kind of thing. To start our business from scratch here, there's a huge amount of undertaking that goes into it. Equipment costs are unbelievable. All of the equipment in our facility is either, if it's a food contact surface, it's stainless steel, any type of non-food contact surface. We'd want to try and use, lightweight metal that's not going to rust. So it's either galvanized or it's aluminum. And of course, none of that stuff is cheap. We just recently purchased a new hog scalder a few years back, and that's a $33,000 machine.
Wow.
So there's a lot of costs that go into it, and not to mention your electrical. Everything that runs in on all your major processing pieces of equipment are running on three phase. It's not just a 110 plug-in that you can plug into the wall, and it takes a lot of electrical to run all of this stuff as well. And then you have your refrigeration on top of that. We have probably, I want to say, 15 to 20 different refrigeration units that run our refrigeration for the inside of the building.
Wow.
Between our coolers and our freezers and different things like that. So, it is a fairly big undertaking to go through. But at the same time, there's people out there that need a facility like ours, like most of the processing facilities that are out there. People want to eat beef. People want to eat pork. So, somebody's got to be there to do it.
Yeah, I don't see that changing anytime soon. Well, let's follow an animal kind of through your facility and talk about, what's happening and what's looking like. I'd like to kind of talk about, the different equipment that's being used, but also the different positions that people can work. So if I am, pulling up to Paradise Lockers with a load of pigs, I'm getting there on, like, what day of the week?
Typically, depending on what it is, all of Heritage Slaughter is typically done on a Monday and Tuesday, of course, barring any USDA holidays. We can't slaughter under USDA unless we have a USDA official here. So if a USDA holiday or a national holiday follows on a Monday or Tuesday, we have to rearrange our schedule a little bit.
Oh, wow. And you pay the USDA inspector, or who pays that salary?
He is a government employee, so his normal 8 hours a day is paid for by the federal government. If we require him to work any overtime that day, we're responsible for paying his overtime.
And is that the norm, or do you guys usually keep it in the 8 hour window?
We definitely try our best to keep it in the 8 hour window, but with the amount of work that we're doing, it's not uncommon for him to have a half an hour of overtime on a slaughter day.
Okay. So I unload my, let's say I've got, half a dozen pigs or whatever. You have, I'm assuming, a holding area for the animals. And do you have any protocols as far as, like, the time frame between, like, when the animals are dropped off and when you'll slaughter them? Is there any kind of, minimum or maximum that the animals need to be on your, property before you'll proceed with slaughter?
Yeah, we definitely like to have the animals here within a certain time frame. Of course, all of our, beef and hogs are different. The way our facility is set up, the way our pens are set up, hogs we can hold overnight. We don't hold hogs for any more than 24 hours. without having to feed. That rarely happens.
Right.
But occasionally, a farmer will have plans that, you know, he has to drop off the 20 hogs for Heritage, and he can't do it on the Monday morning that we need him to. So, you know, maybe he has to do it over the weekend. So, you know, in those kinds of circumstances, we do provide food and different things like that. But we like to try and schedule our drop-offs to where the animals do have time to rest, because a ride in a vehicle, a ride in a trailer can be stressing to an animal.
Definitely stressful,
you know,
sure.
It's out of its normal circumstance, out of its normal habitat, and not sure where it's going or what's happening. So it can be stressful. Not say it is 100% of the time, but can be. So mm-hmm. We do like to have time for those animals to rest. We usually say, you know, a window of about 3 to 4 hours.
Okay.
Once hogs get here, that they need to have time to rest and relax a little bit and get some water in them. And
issues with, like, what's in their belly? I mean, before I would go into surgery, you know, if you have to go into surgery, you know, they want you to have an empty stomach. I mean, is it similar for slaughter?
You know, there are some places that that have said that, because we come across farmers who say, you know, do you guys want us to not feed them the 24 hours in advance or anything like that? And that's not something that we require. You know, it does make things for a little bit easier when you go into, once the animal comes into the slaughter room and after the animal's down, and once you start pulling all the entrails and doing the evisceration of the animal, mm-hmm. Obviously that... If you don't have a stomach full of ingestion or, it does make it easier, but that's not a requirement that we have.
Okay.
I just don't see it necessary for somebody to hold feed back from an animal for 24 hours before it gets here. You know, we just take the extra time to make sure that we're not putting our knives where they don't belong and causing contamination in products.
Sure. So the pigs have been there for somewhere between, you know, 3 and 24 hours. They're in their pen, and then I'm assuming, you know, there's some type of, you know, channel that they walk down where they enter the kill floor. Now, is it kind of one at a time, or are you able to do several animals at a time as far as the actual, you know, when they come onto the kill floor for the first time? Does that make sense?
Okay. Absolutely. In our program, each hog is done individually.
And is that is that pretty standard in like for the size processing facility that
for
you are?
For a smaller custom facility, yes. When you start to look at, you know, some of the bigger plants, they do numerous hogs at one time, numerous animals at one time. But with the way our system is set up and you know, with the humane treatment that we deem necessary for animals to be done here, mm-hmm. not only for the treatment of animals, but for the quality of the product.
And the safety of the workers, too. I mean, I think that's a big thing that kind of gets left out of this discussion oftentimes, too, is that, you know, it can be dangerous for you guys. So, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been, throughout my years of being back on the slaughter floor, I've been kicked a few times, and animals are, they're big. You know, hogs weigh just as much as me, and a beef is 5, 6, 7 times bigger. So they can do some damage if you're not careful. So definitely that is a big part of it as well. The safety of our employees is definitely in the top primary concerns for us when we're doing work back in the shop, and when we're training employees too. You know, everybody's always trained the right way. If this is the right way to do things, not only for the integrity of the meat, not only for the sake of the animal, but for the sake of yourself as well.
Absolutely.
And the safety of the personal safety of our employees. Absolutely.
So the pig is on the kill floor, and are you guys doing a stun, or how do you kind of make the initial takedown?
We do an electronic stun.
Okay.
And it's done behind the head. That the hog is rendered unconscious, and we have about a 30 to 45 second window to get that hog in the air and get the blood out of the animal.
Okay. And that's because if it goes longer, the hog will wake back up, or because...
Won't necessarily will, but can.
But
it's a possibility.
Okay. So
that within that time frame, brain function can return.
So essentially you stun them, which renders them senseless, and then I'm assuming that they're hoisted up by one of their, you know, rear legs, and you mm-hmm. their throat is slit. And mm-hmm.
it's, well, you know, when you think of a throat slit, it's not cut from side to side.
Okay.
To keep possible contamination to a minimum, mm-hmm. We do a straight, in essence, a stick. The knife goes straight into the throat,
okay.
right up towards the heart,
uh-huh.
and a slit is made up towards the heart, and then the knife is pulled out. So there's, you know, about a 1 inch, about the width of a knife, straight into the throat, pulled out, and then the hog bleeds out through there.
Okay. And how long does that take?
You know, the actual physical sticking of the hog is done within seconds.
Sure.
You know, less than 5 seconds from the time that knife goes into the throat to where it's pulled out. And for a hog to bleed out totally, 15 to 20 seconds.
Okay, wow.
So it's a pretty quick process right there.
So then what's the next step?
After that, the hog is hung until all the blood is drained from the pig, and then it goes into the scalder.
Tell us about the scalder. I've seen those. I mean, they basically look like some kind of giant washing machine.
Yes. Yeah. There's two rows, and depending on the size of the machine and the type of the machine, the scalder that we have has two different spindles that have a bunch of different rubber paddles attached to it. And the hog will lay into the back of the machine on top of one of the spindles and next to the other one.
Okay.
There's one down below and then one that sits right next to the hog. And that scalder is filled up with water, and there's a thermocouple in the bottom that heats the water to about 68 degrees Celsius. And there is a hair loosening chemical that's added to the water. And what that does is it helps loosen the hair follicles. So once you turn the machine on, those rubber paddles start to spin. And it's going to roll that hog around, and the rubber paddles are going to grab at the hair and pull the hair out of the skin.
I think it's something that people have, you know, fail to realize. You're used to, you know, storybook pigs and picture pigs are always this kind of pale, kind of creamy, clean white, and that's what, you know, pig skin looks like when you unwrap your, you know, Boston butt with the skin on. But pigs actually have pretty coarse hair that can be different colors, and it covers their entire body.
Heritage breed hogs do.
Yeah.
You know, hogs that are done in the commodity world, you know, at the bigger slaughterhouses, they've bred hogs to have white hair. White hair pulls easier, it scalds easier. It makes for a lot nicer looking skin once it comes out of the scalder, and a lot less work to be done. But when you're talking about purebred hogs, you're talking about Berkshires, Red Wattles, Duroks. You're talking about black hair, red hair. You know, and you would think that the black hair would probably be the worst, but in reality, it's actually the red-haired hogs are the worst. Duroks are by far the worst hogs to scald. They have a very, very thick, coarse red hair.
And scalding isn't something that everyone does. I mean, that's kind of one technique. The other would be to skin the hog.
Correct.
And then you and that's also what you would have to do if you have a really large animal, because, you know, it wouldn't fit in the scalder.
Correct. Yeah, if we put an animal that weighs over 400 pounds live weight, the machine just won't take it, and we'll lose our chain will break.
Okay.
Happened a few times before.
So then what happens? You mean the chain, like as far as the safety?
The drive chain.
Okay.
But actually, it's a chain-driven machine.
Oh, the chain of the actual machine. I got it.
Right. Yeah, so it's the it's, you know, essentially like a bicycle. It's a lot thicker, of course, a lot thicker chain than a bicycle, and it's a double wide chain. But the chain that actually drives the paddles, yeah, I've had that break a few different times on us because of a bigger pig or, you know, other circumstances, things like that. So
when the pig comes out of the scalder, it's hairless at that point, and is that correct?
Somewhat.
Okay, and then you guys might have to do some touch-ups.
Right, with, like I said, with, you know, when you're scalding a white-haired hog, it comes out of the scalder pristine. You know, very, very little hair on it, you know, maybe a couple little spots here and there that you have to work with. When you're talking about black and red hogs, Berkshires, and Durocs, Tamworth, Red Wattles, there's a lot of extra work that needs to be done. I actually have that station, once that hog comes out of the scalder, and it goes onto the scraping cart, that station really controls the speed of the entire room.
Okay.
And I actually have two people on that station. There's one person that brings the hogs in, drops them, bleeds them, puts them into the scalder. One person that eviscerates the hogs or takes the entrails out. One person that splits and washes them. We have two people on the scraping station
to keep up. Yeah. And what are you scraping with? I mean, you're not in there with like a, you know, a bag of Bic razors or something, right?
No, it is. They're done with straight edge knives.
Okay.
And it's just a very, very sharp knife. And once that pig comes out, it's laid down onto the cradle, and any remaining hair is shaved back with a knife, and then it's gone back over with a torch. The outside of the skin has gone back over with a torch that we use, a natural gas torch, to get anything that we can't see, especially like, you know, down in between the toenails or in any of the crevices, like the armpits or anything like that, where
just
you may
like
miss
people.
A spot.
Yeah.
The whole carcass has gone over then and then re-scraped.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And then re-scraped. Just you know, any spots that got missed, it's checked back over one more time and scraped again if it needs to be. And then the hog is rinsed down. The outside of the carcass is rinsed down to get any outside hair or anything like that from contaminating the meat of the carcass.
Okay.
It's raised up on another winch, on a separate winch, and then it's eviscerated. All the entrails are removed. The organs are removed, the liver, heart, lungs, esophagus, all of that. And all of the organs are presented to the inspector. He checks every single animal.
Every animal
our inspector does.
Through.
It's not
wow.
required to. They're required to check every six animals, one out of every six animals. Our inspector checks every single one. And he's checking for, you know, diseases in the liver, lesions, any type of abscesses or anything like that that could result in contaminated meat.
All right.
And then once all of the entrails and all of the organs are out of the carcass, it's raised up to about where the feet are, quite a ways above your head, and the head of the carcass is about eye level. The head is broken back through the bone to where it's just attached by the back of the neck.
Okay.
And then it goes over to our splitting and washing station. Each carcass is individually checked visually from top to bottom to check for any contaminations. Any contaminations being hair, fecal matter, any type of contamination that could cause that product to be unsafe to eat. And then if any are found, they're trimmed off with a knife. They're not just washed off. Washing can spread bacteria. It won't get rid of it.
Okay.
So they're trimmed off with a knife, and then the carcass is split and then washed. Actually, the carcass is split, presented to our inspector, and once he clears it, we wash that. We rinse that carcass down, and it goes to the rail scale to get prepped to where the weight's logged in, and it's tagged, and then it goes into the cooler.
Wow, man, that was awesome. We are at the end of our time. Thank you so much, Nick, for taking some time out of what I know is a busy day for you to walk us through that process. It was awesome.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, we'll be in touch. Tune in next week at 1:00 for the Farm Report every Thursday.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, all over the internet and also in all of the meat trade papers, as well as in this particular article on digital trends, story has been running about the poop burger. Japanese scientists have found a way to create artificial meat from sewage containing human waste. Mitsuyuki Ikeda, a researcher from the Okayama Laboratory, has developed steaks based on proteins from human excrement. Tokyo Sewage approached the scientists because of an overabundance of sewage mud. They asked him to explore the possible uses of the sewage, and Ikeda found that the mud contained a great deal of protein because of all the bacteria. The researchers then extracted those proteins, combined them with a reaction enhancer, and put it in an exploder, which created the artificial steak. The meat is 63% proteins, 25% carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 9% minerals. The researchers color the quote-unquote meat red with food coloring and enhance the flavor with soy proteins. Initial tests have suggested people say that it even tastes like beef. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Kate Kiefer.
Nicole Taylor is always the first to talk with new and exciting personalities in the food world on her show Hot Grease. Check out a little clip.
Everything is super sweet in the Heritage Radio Network studios today. We're chatting with Fanny Gearson. Fanny is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and the 2011 James Beard Foundation Cookbook Award nominee. Oh my God, we fry in Bed-Stuy. We have to talk dough. Donuts. I'm going to have to say, Fanny, I don't know if you know this. I was definitely the first person in Brooklyn to start talking about dough. Did you know that?
I knew that last time I saw you. But I didn't know that before.
So we have to talk dough. I mean, it is a bona fide phenomenon in Brooklyn.
I'm so excited to be part of it. I can't believe it.
You know? I mean, I was just telling you before the show that I think about a month ago, I went to dough on a Sunday at 2 o'clock and all the donuts
were gone. You like what you hear? You can hear Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. live on heritageradionetwork.com. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast or check it out in our archives. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat. The following is a message from Zingerman's. From June 30th to July 3rd, 2011, come hang out at Camp Bacon, a four-day festival hosted by Zingerman's. The main event is an all-day affair at Zingerman's Roadhouse featuring plenty of bacon, bacon learning, and such luminaries as Alan Benton, John T. Edge, Molly Stevens, and more. The event will be taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Proceeds from this event benefit Southern Foodways Alliance. Also, on Friday, July 1st, there'll be a special benefit performance featuring Andre Williams and the Gold Stars and special guest John Langford and Skull Orchard. Visit www.zingermanscampbacon.com for more information and for tickets. Once again, that's www.zingermanscampbacon.com.